Welcome, Action fans, and thanks for joining me on this special breakdown bonus edition of the podcast. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and on this episode, I have the fortune to talk to breakdown director Jonathan Mostow all about the making of the movie. Over the course of the interview, you will hear about the early inspirations behind the movie, how our seasoned star Kurt Russell came on board the film, and the troubles of selling a suspense script in Hollywood. Plus, we get into how some of the stunts on the movie were achieved, his love of practical effects, and his thoughts on the current state of the action genre. All of which, and much more, you can hear right now in my interview with Jonathan. Hi, Jonathan. Welcome to All 90s Action All the Time. Great to have you on the show.
My pleasure to be here.
So we've got you on the show to talk about a film we recently covered, Breakdown, which you were the director of. To start off with, can you tell us about the initial inspiration of Breakdown, which according to IMDb trivia came to you in a drive through Las Vegas? Is that true, or is that just IMDb trivia being IMDb trivia?
Well, that's partially true. I would say people always ask when you run into people who aren't in the entertainment industry and they find out that you are a writer or a director or something, they almost always ask you the same question. Is where do you get your ideas? Where do those ideas come from? Mm-hmm. As if, you know, you crazy show business people, somehow like your brains, you know, sort of, divine these ideas. And, a lot of this is actually fresh in my mind, because we just, went through a process of putting together a special edition, Blu-ray of, Breakdown, which Paramount is going to be releasing. And probably by the time this podcast is aired, the Blu-ray will be out. I think its street date is September 21.
And yes, by the time this episode comes out, it'll have been out for about a week. So anybody listening can buy that Blu-ray right now.
Perfect. And you know, there's two versions out there. There's one that an Australian distributor did without much participation from me, and then there's the Paramount version, which I was deeply involved in, and actually has a commentary track with me and Kurt Russell. We went in and recorded that a few months ago. And so a lot of this is very fresh in my mind. And I would say there are three stimuli that resulted in Breakdown. Number one was when I was a young kid, my father took me to this Hitchcock double feature. And one of the movies was The Lady Vanishes, which was sort of an early Hitchcock effort. And it's actually, I think it probably more plays as a light comedy nowadays, but for me at age, you know, 10 or whatever I was at the time, it was utterly gripping. And the idea in that story is a man meets a woman on a train, and then, he goes off, I don't know, to the dining car. When he comes back, she's gone and nobody seems to have remembered her ever existing. And I found that a very gripping idea. And I think at some level, I had to sort of exorcise that out of my subconscious. The second stimulus was, as you say, and I probably had mentioned this in an interview at the time, you know, sometimes I would drive, I'm in Los Angeles, if I would go maybe with some friends or something to go to Las Vegas, we would drive. It's like a 5-6 hour drive and you're out in the middle of the desert and, you know, you see these like little shacks or a rundown trailer home, you know, a half mile off the road in the middle of nowhere. And you're sort of thinking, who lives there? Like what's going on there? And it just sort of, you know, and if you're at all mildly paranoid, which I probably am, you start to sort of spin kind of scary scenarios in your head. So that was sort of the second, source of the idea. And the third was, your listeners will probably find a little bit more amusing perhaps, which was, I had been hired to direct a movie based on a Stephen King short story. And it was a short story called Trucks. And it had been made into a movie in the 80s that Stephen King himself actually directed.
Oh, you mean Maximum Overdrive.
Maximum Overdrive, right. And I don't think that it was necessarily, you know, considered Citizen Kane, but the producer I was working with owned the underlying short story, and that was Dino De Laurentiis. And Dino felt like, you know what, let's try this again, but let's go back to the short story. So I'd been working and developing that. I had even scouted locations out in the desert. And then, at some point we developed a script that was actually pretty good. And then, the business affairs guy came in one day and he said, oh yeah, we can't call this Stephen King's Trucks. Like in the poster, you won't be able to say Stephen King's Trucks. It'll just have to say Trucks. And suddenly the entire financial reason to make the movie, which is that you could have a poster that said Stephen King's Trucks, that went away. So the movie suddenly was like canceled. And I was like, wait a second. I developed a script and I got locations and everything else. And I kind of in a sort of moment of desperation was thinking, how can I salvage the situation? And that's when I came up with the original idea for Breakdown. And then I wrote the script actually very quickly and had nothing to do with trucks. It had nothing to do with the Stephen King short story other than the fact that it took place in the desert. That was the only common link. So that's how Breakdown came about.
So it seems like it was a really quick turnaround from writing the script to going into production. It sounds like it was quite a quick turnaround there.
It was fairly quick. The original idea was, and also I was trying to write something I could do in a low budget. So I thought, oh, this is perfect. It's out in the desert. We don't need lights. You know, there's no real location fees to pay. This will be very inexpensive. I could, you know, when I was at the beginning of my career and, you know, I'd only basically made like one little movie and I had then been, it kind of got me recognized in Hollywood, and I had various development deals on movies. But the obstacle I kept running into is it's very hard to make the leap from doing a small $1 million budgeted movie, at least it was at that time, to doing something bigger. So I was attached to projects, but then I would sort of get removed as the director before, you know, the project could get to the starting line. Some of these movies got made without me. Some of them never got made. And so I realized, you know what? I got to write my own thing. I got to write my own thing and then insist that if somebody wants to make it, I have to be the director. And so that's really what Breakdown was. I'm sorry. I think I forgot your question.
No, I was just talking about the kind of quick turnaround between filming.
Yes. So, you know, it had been, you know, like 5 years since I'd made the movie that had gotten me sort of attention in Hollywood. And, you know, so I had only experienced that. But for me, Hollywood was this place where, like, you know, dreams come to die. You know, it was, I had all these projects that I would be in love with, and then they just wouldn't happen. And so suddenly, you know, I wrote Breakdown, and my idea was to make it fairly inexpensively. And then the producer said, well, who do you want to star in it? And I said, well, my dream would be Kurt Russell. And so the producer went out and made a sizable offer to Kurt. And then he came aboard and suddenly it was going. And I kind of couldn't believe it. After years of sort of what felt like banging my head against the wall, suddenly it was sort of like slicing warm butter. Now I should say it wasn't a clear shot. It wasn't like, oh, here's the script, folks, and then people like showering me with money to make it. It actually did have some hiccups, and one of them was that originally I wrote the script and tried to, you know, see if I could get it sold at one of the studios, and all the studios passed. And then the only person that actually bought the script at that point was Dino and Martha De Laurentiis. And then with Dino and Martha, we attached Kurt, and, you know, we thought, okay, great. Now we're making the movie. And Kurt was, you know, a very big movie star at that time. Certainly, you know, a big enough star to get a distribution deal with one of the major studios. And, all the studios passed again. And, you know, and the feedback would be like, well, this doesn't really work, and it's not very effective, and, you know, it's not suspenseful. And I'd already learned at that point already, because of some other projects I'd been involved with, that with suspense scripts, the way that executives in Hollywood read scripts is that they, you know, back in the day when they were physically printed out, you know, on a printer, the executive would literally take home a cardboard box of scripts for the weekend. They'd have to read like 15 or 20 scripts over the weekend. And then Monday morning come into the studio, and there'd be a meeting of all the creative executives, and everybody would talk about the scripts that they'd read and compare notes or whatever. So the process of reading scripts was one where, if from an executive standpoint, you need to know what happens, and you need to know what happens so you don't look like a moron in the Monday morning meeting. So you learn to read scripts very quickly, and you're flipping through to basically just, you know, find out what happens. And so 120 page script, you know, a good executive can read that in, you know, 30, 40 minutes. And the problem with suspense is that suspense exists not, it's not in the dialogue. It's not in the lines of description. Suspense exists kind of between the lines of dialogue and the lines of description. Yeah. And so you almost need to imbibe a suspense script in real time. And executives just don't have the time to do that. It's just, it's a hugely demanding job that goes at breakneck pace. And so that's what I found that with some other suspense things I've been involved with, and I found it as well with Breakdown, which is just people, they wouldn't get it. They'd be like, oh, well, this is a guy, he's driving through the desert, he has some problems, why should I care? What's good about this? And so the only reason the movie got made is that Dino and Martha believed in it enough to say, you know what? We're going to take the risk on this. We're going to take the financial risk. And, they had pre-sold half of the, they pre-sold some of the foreign rights. So they had half the budget covered, but the other half of the budget they covered out of their own pocket, at least to begin with. And it was only until we had already been shooting for a month and a half that they bought some footage to Paramount, and Paramount saw it, and then they came aboard as the U.S. distributor. So, you know, but again, from my perspective as a filmmaker, I was making my movie. So it felt like it was a quick turnaround. Although when I look back on it, it was certainly fraught with a lot of, you know, what seemed at the time sort of setbacks and almost disasters of the thing falling apart.
And going on to kind of the filming, I was kind of wondering, you know, obviously you mentioned, obviously we're covering a season on them that, you know, Kurt Russell was a big star at the time. And, you know, there was other name actors in the film. It's J.T. Walsh's final performance in a movie in his lifetime. And Kathleen Quinlan, you know, these are all kind of name actors. And, you know, this is your second feature. You're 35 years old. You know, like, were you nervous? Like, you know, first day of shooting, you know, like shooting with these actors?
Yeah, I mean, there's, I think any filmmaker who arrives on the set, particularly in the first day, and isn't nervous is either a sociopath or a narcissist or just stupid. And this was, you know, and this is a movie that I originally intended to be a low budget movie, and suddenly it had, you know, Kurt was a very expensive movie star, and suddenly it was a big, you know, it was on track to be sort of a studio sized movie. So it was still small, you know, it wasn't like a big tentpole budget, but it was a far greater budget than anything I'd ever worked with. And so, yeah, there was an aspect of it that was intimidating. The thing that made it, not so much that it was paralyzing was that, I had this great gift from Kurt Russell. And that was that immediately prior to filming Breakdown, he was shooting the sequel of Escape from New York, and it was the movie Escape from LA. And it was all took place at night, and it was a long shoot. It was like, I think it was like 70 nights, which is, you know, like 4 months of shooting or something. Mm-hmm. And when you're on a night schedule, it means that, you know, you show up for work, maybe like 5, 6 p.m. and you shoot all night. And then you wrap, and then you go home and you sleep during the day, and then it, you know, starts up again at night. And so Kurt said to me, and he had signed on to do Breakdown right as he was going off to do Escape from LA. And he said, look, I have to stay up on the weekends. Like, cause you can't, like, you know, comes Friday and Saturday, you don't just suddenly shift back to a regular schedule. Otherwise you're going to, you know, it's too physically demanding. So you just stay on kind of that night schedule. So he said, I got to stay up on weekends. So if you'd be willing to come over to my house at like, you know, 10 at night on, you know, Saturday and Sunday nights, we can just work until you're too tired, and we could, you know, just sort of go through the script and talk about ideas and everything else. So, for months, I would go to his house, show up there, you know, around 10 o'clock, and, you know, the rest of his family is, you know, Goldie and Kate and everybody are like shuffling off to bed in pajamas. And we would sit in like a room in his house. And, we would, and, you know, I was young enough that I, you know, and still used to kind of pulling all nighters from college, I suppose, that we would work until like, you know, 4 a.m. And, what we did is we just would talk through the script, like literally just beat by beat. And so that when it came time to film, he and I knew exactly what we wanted to do. A lot of time gets wasted on movies because, you know, you come in the morning and you're sort of blocking out the scene. And then, you know, the movie star has like basic questions like, well, what am I doing in this scene? Or why is my character doing this? Or why is he coming through the door instead of, you know, climbing through the window, whatever it is. Then you're stopping to have all these conversations. Well, we had had all those conversations, and it was especially helpful in the case of Breakdown, because part of the deal that Kurt had made on the film was that, even though we were filming all over the Southwest United States, we were in like Utah and Arizona and Nevada and Northern California, he was sleeping at home in his bed in Los Angeles every night. So, every day, every morning he would be picked up, driven to the local private airport, flown by private jet to an airstrip, where a helicopter was waiting with the blades already going. He'd go into the helicopter. The helicopter would fly him typically like, you know, 5 or 10 minutes to our base camp. Then he'd go into makeup and wardrobe. And then I would get him on set maybe like 11:30 in the morning. We'd shoot for, you know, an hour or so, break for lunch, come back after lunch, shoot another few hours, and then the helicopter would come back and pick him up, and, you know, he'd fly back to LA. So, I had, you know, half the number of hours on set with him every day that you normally would have with the star of your movie. And it worked great because A, we had talked through everything, and B, you know, Kurt is such a pro that it was rare that we were, you know, doing more than 3 or 4 takes for any particular setup. So your question was it intimidating? And I would say, you know, it's probably most intimidating when you're talking about dealing with your movie star, because they're really, you know, they're the 800-pound gorilla, so to speak, in these things. But what I found in my career is that most movie stars with longevity, which Kurt certainly had, and has, they understand that their career depends on doing the best possible movie. And the best possible movie happens when everybody you're working with feels comfortable. So my experience has been that most movie stars are incredibly gifted at making everyone around them, especially director, feel at ease, comfortable, not intimidated. So I would say it's Kurt's personality coupled with that particular unusual circumstance, made it feel really great just right from the beginning.
And I have to say that, from the research I've done this season, I definitely get that sense that, you know, Kurt is a team player. Unlike some other people we've covered on the podcast so far.
Yeah, right. And by the way, I mean, especially, you know, what's interesting about your show is looking specifically at the 90s, you know, and just look at the actors from the 90s that are still working today, you know, that are still in big movies with, you know, and still have a big audience. And look at the actors that have sort of faded out. And I would say that probably in almost all cases, the actors that, but it's not fair to say entirely because there's some actors that are wonderful people that for whatever reason, their careers didn't work out. But, you know, I certainly know that some of those actors were awful to work with, you know. Again, I've been lucky. Most of the actors I've worked with have just been fantastic collaborators and great people, and you'd want to go out and have a beer with them any day of the week. It's interesting. It's definitely interesting.
Yeah, for sure. I did want to talk a little bit about as well, how difficult it was filming some of the stunts in the movie, particularly the one where Kurt Russell's character is clambering the undercarriage of the lorry and then comes up on the side of the lorry. That seems like complicated stuff. And did Kurt Russell do his own stunts for that?
Yeah, Kurt did most of his own stunts in the movie. The interesting thing about, especially if you're both a writer and director, which I am, is when you're writing a script, you can only wear your writer's hat. Otherwise, you just get too up in your head. So you wear your writer's hat, and you just imagine what you want to see on screen with no regard to, well, how is that going to be possible? And then when you're done with the script, you take off that writer's hat, you put on your director's hat, and then, which is a much more analytical hat. And then you look at these sequences and, you know, the first thing you go is, oh my God, how is that going to be possible? How do we do that? You know, and the fun of making movies is that what you discover is that everything's possible and you just have to break it down. No pun. You have to break it down into its component parts and isolate it down into it every little isolated element. And then you're figuring out how to do it. There was a fantastic film that came out 2 years ago, and it won the Oscar for best documentary, Free Solo.
All right. Yeah.
If your listeners haven't seen that film, I can't recommend it highly enough. And it is a real life documentary about this guy, Alex Honnold, that, does free climbing, which is got to be the most dangerous thing imaginable. And he climbs up these, you know, 3,000 sheer vertical drop off rock faces with no climbing equipment, just his hands and his feet. And the movie details his attempt to climb this, cliff, 3,000 foot cliff, in the U.S. that nobody had ever tried before because it would literally be suicide. And how he does it is he literally plans out the climb, literally just toe hold by toe hold.
My apologies.
Oh, that's my – sorry. That was my Apple Watch just spoke up. And he maps it all out. He memorizes it, and then he executes. And that's exactly how you do – any stunt sequence. So, in the case of that particular sequence, I'm always loath to give away the secrets to, to people who haven't yet seen the movie, cause they don't want, you know, I want them just to sort of, enjoy the movie. But, in the case of that, it was a combination of stuff done in a real truck, some stuff done where, literally we're in a parking lot, but the camera is tilted up. So you don't realize that the truck's not moving, but the truck is shaking and we're blowing high speed wind. There are shots where you're looking down at Kurt and, you know, he's just inches above the asphalt. Well, that was actually a thing that the special effects guys manufactured, which was basically like a treadmill where the treadmill was painted to look like asphalt. And then, you know, it just reads as, you know, as road moving underneath him. So, again, you in all these sequences, you tend to use a combination of techniques and you mix them up and then you're just constantly tricking the viewer's eye. I think one of the reasons that Breakdown still feels like a visceral film is there's basically no CGI in it. You know, there's a couple of matte paintings, like a digital two-dimensional matte painting, but other than that, there's no computer generated graphics. And, you know, and I've certainly done a ton of CGI, obviously, in my career. And the challenge always with that stuff is just to make it look as real as the real thing. So there's no substitute for just shooting something for real. So putting Kurt on the real truck and having him do that stuff, you know, it's hard to go wrong.
And do you think that people are maybe craving the real thing more again? Because, like, I feel that your film Breakdown has grown in stature over the years, and I do feel also that with the success of things like John Wick, that there is a kind of drive towards that kind of more throwback feel of an action movie.
That's a great question. I mean, it's interesting because Breakdown, when it came out, even at that point, so Breakdown came out in 1997, and that was just sort of at almost the starting point. And the starting point maybe was, starting point had already happened. I mean, you had Jurassic Park, you had Twister, you already had some big spectacle movies that had, you know, that were starting to define
Independence Day 96.
Exactly, yeah. And those were starting to define what movies were going to become. They're going to become these giant, huge budget, you know, special effects filled blockbusters. So in the summer that the Breakdown came out, there was, you know, I think the week, right, you see the week before, the week after, there's this movie Volcano, which I think was The Volcano Erupts and, you know, engulfs Los Angeles or something. They're all these just sort of like high concept, sort of big spectacle action films. And, so already people immediately said, oh wow, this is like a throwback, you know, and kind of embraced it really kind of from the get-go. I've always found within the Beltway of Hollywood, there was an appreciation for it because, you know, most people who make movies, they, you know, certainly at that point, like me, they'd grown up really on a diet of movies from the 70s, all those great, you know, French Connection and The Sting and, you know, it can go on and on. Right. Mm-hmm. And, pretty much anything with Paul Newman or Robert Redford or Steve McQueen or whatever. and that's the stuff that had inspired people to go into the film business, to go into making movies, right? And people didn't, you know, there's very few filmmakers, at least at the time, and I would argue maybe even still, that, you know, came to Hollywood going, I want to make something full of like giant things exploding and spaceships crashing into other spaceships, right? I mean, certainly those people exist and maybe some of those people sort of go into special effects, but if you're a storyteller at heart, you care about character, you know, and if you're a storyteller like me, you want a story with a real character at the center of it, but also, you know, with some sort of scope and size and pace to the story, because that's something gets your adrenaline going. That's sort of what floats my own boat, right? Mm-hmm. So I think within the film business, people recognize Breakdown as like, okay, here's a film that kind of gets your pulse quickening, but it's also feels real, and there's a real performance there, and it's about, you know, it's a real character. So as, you know, special effects and visual effects made anything imaginable possible, and you're getting to these movies with, you know, $300 million budgets, the audience has sort of seen everything that can be seen. You know, there's really, it's pretty hard to wow the audience. You know, in the 90s, and since your show's about the 90s, I would say that that was sort of the two films that most wowed the audience. And it's hard to think of anything since that visually has wowed the audience as much as Terminator 2, which was, you know, the liquid metal Terminator, the Robert Patrick character, and then Jurassic Park, where you actually saw like dinosaurs on screen. And, you know, those two movies, when if you're old enough to have seen those in the theater when they came out, the audience's jaws were on the floor. They'd never seen anything like that, you know? And then ever since, everybody has just sort of been doing iterations of that. And the only thing that's really changed is the quantity of visual effect shots. So, for example, a big Marvel movie or a big special effects tentpole movie nowadays, it'll have, you know, probably 1,500 visual effect shots. And if you think back to, you know, one of the interesting statistics about Terminator 2, which is, again, changed the game for so many, for the audience and for filmmakers, that only had like 90 visual effect shots in it, but they had huge impact on the audience because people had never seen that before. They were like watching an object literally transform into another object, like magically, that had just never been seen before. So two things happen when you start getting to these films that have 1,500 visual effects. Number one is that, it sort of becomes eye fatigue for the viewer, right? Because it's just like, it's just so much visual information to take in. And it just becomes like, it's like going to a buffet that has 1,500 dishes at it. It's just overwhelming, right? The other thing, and you don't hear this ever really spoken about, but, you know, it's definitely a conversation that I've had with other directors, is that there's filmmaker fatigue, and each one of those visual effect shots is a production unto itself. Each visual effect shot, whether it's, you know, and they range from, you know, a half a second to maybe, you know, a long visual effect shot might be, you know, several seconds. You know, occasionally you have some incredible shot that, you know, could go on for, you know, 30 seconds or something. But even though they're so short, they require incredible planning. Each shot requires, and I'm not exaggerating, probably anywhere from 20 to 50 meetings. And that's the conceptualization. How are we going to do it? How are we actually going to, what's the methodology we're going to use this visual effect shot? Is it all going to be done on the computer? Is part of it going to be shot for real? Is there a visual element to it? Do we have to go to, you know, Argentina and shoot a plate of a waterfall that then we're going to digitally enhance? Like, so you have all these meetings about that. And then you get into the actual making of the shot. And there's all the departments, whether you're dealing with ILM or one of the other effects houses, there within that, there's all these departments. There's animation, there's lighting, there's rendering. There's all these different aspects that go into the shot. And so you're seeing, the director is seeing the progress of the shot as it's making its way through. And then they finally get the shot to where they're proposing, the effects company's proposing, okay, we think this is good enough to put in the movie. And then the director and his visual effects team working on the movie they're reviewing it and they're saying, no, that looks fake, or no, the way the character is moving doesn't look like it's obeying the law of physics or whatever. And you have, again, it's called the review process, and many, many more meetings like that. So that in all that time, and those meetings they happen starting in pre-production. They're happening while you're shooting the film. They're happening in post-production. And so all the time you're spending in those meetings, you are not talking to the actors. You're not just alone in the editing room with your editor trying to, you know, make the scene work better or the pace of the movie work better. You're not working on the script. You're not, you know, doing any of the other millions of jobs, working with the composer, any one of the other millions of jobs that you have as a director. You're in sort of these visual effects meetings. And because particularly in a large movie, and I'm sorry, I may be giving, answering a question you didn't ask or giving you an answer.
It's okay.
but I've actually never sort of spoken about this, at least in an interview. Visual effects almost always, well, in fact, I'd say 99.9%, if not 100% of the time on big movies, the single biggest budgetary item in the budget for the film are the visual effects. And, you know, so, you know, if you're doing a $200 million movie, it's quite likely the visual effects budget is $50 million, you know? So because it's so expensive, it sort of is the, always is like demands kind of the most attention. Everybody's the most nervous about it. And so it always takes priority. So, you know, I remember doing a movie where I had a really wonderful Oscar winning editor who it was his first big visual effects movie. And I remember post-production at one point, he just turned to me and said, you know, I never want to do one of these visual effects movies again because I'm spending most of my time, you know, in these technical conversations about the shots, about the visual effects shots, as opposed to what is the core of my craft, which is shaping the architecture of the movie and the scenes and the drama and the pace and telling the story. So, what happens in these situations, because directors are only human, right? And there's only one of them per movie, unless it's, you know, like a directing team. But it's almost always just one person. It's like kind of just overwhelming. And yet even though your job is to make sure all those visual effects shots turn out great, what's your real job? Your real job is to make sure the movie's great, to make sure you're telling the story in a way that's compelling and not boring and dramatically gripping and emotionally moving and all that kind of stuff. And it's a real balancing game. There's guys like Jim Cameron that do it effortlessly. They are masters. And Jim Cameron, in my mind, is not just a great writer. He's not just a great director. His gift is he can keep, you know, look at Avatar, which is all visual effect shots. He can keep, you know, 2,500 visual effect shots in his head and supervise and manage all those and still tell a great story. You know, few other filmmakers on the planet can do that. And so, and I have seen movies, where, you know, I've run into the director right before the movie comes out and they look like they've been hit upside the head with a baseball bat. They look like literally just dazed. And I'll say to them, how many visual effect shots in your movie? And they'll say, oh, you know, 1800 or something. And I just know at that point, just from looking at them, I just say to myself, boy, I will be surprised if that movie turns out well, you know? And at the end of the day, the visual effect shots almost always look great, but the movie might not necessarily work. So one of the advantages, to go back to your question, that like a John Wick has is that, and even though there are quite a few visual effect shots in a John Wick film, but they're so craftily and beautifully done, you wouldn't even notice. It's comparatively very few visual effect shots, at least, you know, say compared to a Marvel movie. And, the filmmakers can really focus on telling the story and, you know, making sure that that works. So that's like a lens into the process, the filmmaking process that doesn't really get talked about. But I think is in fact, what explains why by and large, a lot of the big effects driven movies sort of, there's a certain soullessness often to them, or there's just certain kind of like narrative flabbiness to them. You don't, when you're talking about these giant tentpole movies, you don't often hear people describe them as lean and mean, you know? So to take it back to Breakdown, unburdened by visual effects, I had the luxury to just focus on telling that story, you know, and just make it work from that standpoint. So, anyway, I'll get off my soapbox now, but that's my.
No, that's okay. It was, interesting listening to you, talking about all that and, your thoughts on that. So that's all fine. So I know you're a very busy man. We're already slightly, overrunning. So I just fit in like one last question before I let sure. you go. How much fun was it, revisiting the film and doing the recording of the commentary, with Kurt Russell? For the new Blu-ray?
Oh, and it was so much fun to go back. You know, I remember before I ever did a movie, you know, in that period of my career where I'd moved out to Hollywood and I was just, you know, trying to struggle to just even make a living, and just becoming a director was like just a distant dream in my head. I remember seeing an interview with a director on a big national, TV interview show. And the director sort of casually mentioned something in the interview about how he had never seen one of his films after he'd finished them. And the interviewer had the same reaction I did watching, which is like, what? Wait, you've never seen any of your films after you finished them? That's crazy. Right. And this director just said, no, once I'm done, I just kind of move on. And I thought to myself, okay, that's nuts. If I ever get to direct a movie, I mean, maybe I won't watch it every day, but I think every week I would watch it. I would sit down and watch it every week. I bet that just, you know, or certainly I would watch it a lot, you know. And the funny thing to me is that all these years later, I am the same way. Like once I finish a film, you know, and keep in mind, I have seen it, you know, 50 million times in the editing room. Yeah. And then I've seen it, then it's released and then you're going to like kind of some screenings of it, or there's premieres, and then, you know, you have your Hollywood premiere and then you fly overseas and you have, you know, some premieres in foreign cities. So if you've sat through it, you know, typically four or five times with an audience, right? And you can't, it's like, you have no perspective on it anymore. Like it's, you're so inside of it. And then you go on to do something else. And then whatever, you don't ever go back and see it. I mean, sometimes, you know, back when, you know, I still watch linear television, you know, if I'm sort of flipping around and, you know, suddenly on, you know, HBO or something, I flipped and oh, there's my movie, and it's sort of halfway through and I'm like, oh, I'll watch a few minutes of this. And then I kind of wind up watching, oh, I watched 20 minutes of it, or maybe I'll watch it to the end. That happened a couple of times, but I never sought it out to sit there and watch it. So I had, the only other time I'd seen the film start to finish was some years ago. Like I showed it to a couple of my kids who were old enough to watch it at that point. But other than that, I never had sat down to watch it again. So sitting there with Kurt, who again, same thing for him, you know, it's like you do it, you finish it, and then you mentally move on. It's an interesting process. I guess it's a little bit like probably going to an old high school reunion and you see people who you'd forgotten, but you see their faces and, you know, at least at a high school reunion, people of age. So you know, but still they look the same to you. But in a movie, the faces are exactly the faces that you remembered, you know, because they've been preserved and all these memories start coming back. And what's so interesting is how much you remember. You know, few of us can remember what we were doing, you know, 20 years ago. But there's something about the process of making a film that focuses your thoughts at the time that maybe those memories just get implanted in just a different part of the brain that makes the recall easier. But both Kurt and I, had just really specific detailed memories of what was happening in certain moments, what we were doing. I mean, we remember everything. Sometimes he would remind me of something I'd forgotten and vice versa. But generally speaking, it was very interesting to unlock those sort of, those little memory boxes, for lack of a better word. And Kurt, you know, has a reputation for doing very entertaining commentaries. So I hope that, I certainly enjoyed sitting there, you know, as a participant with him, I enjoyed sitting there listening to him, you know, talk about his recollections of the film and comment on specific moments. And I actually got a chance to ask him some questions that I never asked him before about the film and about his performance. So that was also interesting, but it was enjoyable, and I hope that people who get a chance to listen to that commentary track will enjoy hearing it as much as I enjoyed recording it.
Excellent. Well, I'll look forward to picking that up. As I've said, when this episode goes out, it will be out. But I'll be interested to listen to that. And thank you very much for giving your thoughts on this episode of the show and coming on.
My pleasure, and good luck with the show. And thanks for having me.
That was my guest, Jonathan Mostow there, who I'd like to thank for coming on this inaugural interview edition of the podcast. Also, I'd like to thank all you listeners for tuning into this bonus episode. Please do get in touch if you would like to hear more of this sort of thing on the podcast. Also, please make sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And it would be great if you could leave us a 5-star review because it really helps us with those old algorithms. Anyway, that is all for this time. But be sure to listen out for our season finale covering the movie Soldier next Wednesday. Until then, though, see ya.